You are listening to a sermon series from Open Door Fellowship Church.
Good morning, everyone. Whoa, that was just scattered out. That was nebulous. Come on, one time. Good morning, everyone. Boom. Okay. Hey, I got to go see you too. This week. Come on. Ann Cotty and Ann Gill and Stacy and myself, we got to go. And man, he's like a hero of mine, Bono. He's just a... Yeah, absolutely. Two observations from that time. One, it is not only Sunday morning when we get to worship. Yeah, that was a powerful, powerful experience of worship for me. And the second was this observation, that maybe I should have seen him earlier in my life. They started playing 20 minutes after I usually am asleep in bed. So that was an odd feeling to think, oh gosh, and there's going to be traffic. It's going to be 4 hours before I see my bed. So anyway. Hey, you are in the Ecclesiastes series, Life Worth Living. I hope you are enjoying it as much as we are enjoying it. Thank you. Thank you for that person over there who said that. Really, so. I can't tell you what an honor it is to do this series. I get to do it with Stuart Black, my hero, my big brother. His great-grandfather was the one who helped untie the donkey for Jesus. And then on the other end, you've got Clint Levitt, and it's just an absolute blast. And then to get to do a series with your own son. Wow. Man, oh man, oh man. So I honestly, by the way, it's a little bit too bright. I can smell the hair on my, starting to burn. I don't know why this room isn't filled up for both services. Man, I'm talking to the wrong people. You're actually here, but... Man, it's not too late. Bring your friends to this series. I'm so pleased. We're a little over halfway with this message today, a little bit over halfway done. So delighted. Listen, you'll know in a second, we're in Ecclesiastes chapter 6, and you'll know in a few minutes why I'm going to read this piece to you from Max Lucado. I've never known if it's Lucado or Lucado. You say Lucado, I say Lucado. But look at this. I wrote this to my wife. I got it for her as a gift to my precious wife on her 34th birthday, a book about your best friend, Love, John. So that was 2 years ago. 2 years ago when I did that. Thank you. Once there was an old man who lived in a tiny village. Although poor, he was envied by all, for he owned a beautiful white horse. Even the king coveted his treasure. A horse like this had never been seen before. Such was its splendor, its majesty, its strength. People offered fabulous prices for the steed, but the old man always refused. "This horse is not a horse to me," he would tell them. "It's a person. How could you sell a person? He's a friend, not a possession. How could you sell a friend?" The man was poor and the temptation was great, but he never sold the horse. One morning he found that the horse was not in the stable, and the village came to see him. "You old fool," they scoffed. "We told you someone would steal your horse. We warned you that you would be robbed. You are so poor, how could you ever hope to protect such a valuable animal? It would have been better just to have sold him. You could have gotten whatever price you wanted. No amount would have been too high. But now the horse is gone, and you've been cursed with misfortune." The old man responded, "Don't speak too quickly. Say only this, that the horse is not in the stable. This is all we know. The rest is judgment. If I've been cursed or not, how can you know? How can you judge?" The people contested, "Don't make us out to be a fool. We may not be philosophers, but great philosophy is not needed. The simple fact that your horse is gone, it's a curse." The old man spoke again, "All I know is that the stable is empty and the horse is gone. The rest I don't know. Whether it's a curse or a blessing, I can't say. All we see is a fragment. Who can say what will come next?" Well, the people of the village laughed and mocked. They thought that the man was crazy. They had always thought he was a fool. If he wasn't, he would have sold the horse and lived off the money. But instead, he was a poor woodcutter, an old man still cutting firewood and dragging it out of the forest and selling it. He lived hand to mouth in the misery of poverty. Now he had proven that he was indeed a fool. Well, after 15 days, the horse returned. He hadn't been stolen. He had run away into the forest. And not only had he returned, he brought a dozen wild horses with him. Once again, the village people gathered around the woodcutter and spoke, "Old man, you were right, and we were wrong. We thought it was a curse, but it was a blessing. Please forgive us." And the man responded, "Once again, you go too far. Say only that the horse is back, state only that a dozen horses returned with him, but don't judge. How do you know if this is a blessing or not? You only see a fragment. Unless you know the whole story, how can you judge? You read only a page of the book. Can you judge the whole book? You can only read a phrase. Can you understand the entire phrase? Life is so vast, yet you judge all of life with one word or one page. All you have is a fragment. Don't say this is a blessing. No one knows. I'm content with what I know. I'm not perturbed by what I don't know." "Oh, maybe the old man's right," they said to one another. So they said little, but deep down they knew he was wrong. They knew it was a blessing. 12 wild horses had returned with one horse. With a little bit of work, the animals could be broken and trained and sold for a lot of money. The old man had a son, an only son. The young man began to break the wild horses. After a few days, he fell from one of the horses and broke both legs. And once again, the villagers gathered around the old man and they cast their judgments. "You were right," they said. "You proved you were right. The dozen horses were not a blessing. They were a curse. Your only son's now broken his legs, and now in your old age you have no one to help you. Now you're poorer than ever." And the old man spoke again. "You people are obsessed with judging. Don't go so far. Say only that my son broke his legs. Who knows if it's a blessing or a curse? No one knows. We only have a fragment. Life comes in fragments." Well, it so happened that a few weeks later, the country engaged in a war against a neighboring country, and all the young men of the village were required to join the army. Only the son of the old man was excluded because he was injured. Once again, the people gathered around the old man crying and screaming because their sons had been taken. There was little chance that they would return. The enemy was strong and the war would be a losing struggle. They would never see their sons. "You're right, old man. God knows you were right. This proves that your son's accident was a blessing. His legs may be broken, but at least he's with you. Our sons are gone forever." And the old man spoke again. "It is impossible to speak with you people. You always draw conclusions. No one knows. Say only this, your sons had to go to war and mine did not. No one knows. No one knows if it's a blessing or a curse. No one is wise enough to know. Only God knows." This passage is about that story today. It is about why we trust, how important trust is, what trust does, and it lays us bare. Solomon may be a mess, but he didn't lose his wisdom, and his understanding in this book, gosh, I hope you guys are keeping that journal. I asked you to keep a journal, I think the second or first week we started this. I hope you're finding yourself in Solomon's journey. Now, Solomon today, he's giving truth. Sometimes it's an over-response, but wow, the truth that he gives is unbelievable here. How many of you know someone or have seen someone in a movie who would say things like this? God, if I could just get you to do what I know would be best for me, life would be so much happier. Have you ever met anyone who would say such a thing? God, you must not love me enough because you and I both know what would make me happiest and you're withholding it. God, I'm not so sure you're all-powerful. If you were powerful, you'd know that you'd want to give me what would make me happy. Or maybe this last one. Maybe you know someone closer who might say this. God, now listen, I know what we need to do here. We can fix this. I just don't understand why you won't allow this to happen. Amen?
Amen.
Amen. So today, I want us to take a look at an outline that looks, it looks like wisdom. First, getting everything you could possibly desire is not guarantee your ability to enjoy it. That's his first six verses in this passage. Second set, the quality of what is in front of you endlessly surpasses the promise of what you desire. And third, and this is the one from the story, you don't know yourself well enough to know what's best for you. And you don't know the outcomes of the world that you would set in motion. Only God does. Guys, put on theology caps, thinking caps, focus in, get your camera ready to take some snapshots. I've got 10 slides, way too many slides, but if I wrote them, the least you can do is take pictures of them. Okay. So, if anything this is teaching, it's this. One, don't waste your time arguing with him. Go ahead, argue, but it might be a waste of time. Second, don't miss the life he's currently giving you. Third, don't pretend you know better than God. And fourth, do not resent the life he has waiting for you. So getting everything you could possibly desire does not guarantee your ability to enjoy it. He says right at the start of this, there is an evil which I've seen under the sun. Remember, now he's underneath the tapestry and the threads are jangled and they're all different colored and it's all garland. He can't find his way through this forest of threads. And from under the sun, this is what he sees. It makes no sense to him. He's right about what he observes, but it makes no sense to him. It's a grievous evil. When I see from that vantage point, God makes no sense, life makes no sense. There's an evil that I've seen from under the sun. Now, he's not saying God's evil. He's not saying what God is doing is evil. He is saying that the outcome of unbelief can be evil. You're gonna read in this passage three or four times the term soul. The word that's being used here in the Old Testament is nephesh. And nephesh, it can, and one or two times it carries the idea of passion or appetite, desire, but most of the time it's just talking about me in the totality of who I am as a person. 70 times in the Old Testament, soul just simply means my very being. So when you run across that and he says, there's an evil which I've seen under the sun is prevalent among men, a man to whom God has given riches and wealth and honor so that his soul, his very being, lacks nothing of all that he desires, yet God has not empowered him to eat from them, for a foreigner enjoys them. There's another word that you're going to see in here a lot, it's desire. Desire, 1, 2, 3 times in the passage. Desire, in this context, in these words, in 6:2, maybe it's only twice it's in the passage, but in 6:2 it carries the idea of greediness or craving or longing. It's this. So here in verse 2, his soul lacks nothing of all that he craves, of all that he desires. And verse 6:9, when it says, what the eye sees is better than what the soul desires. In that case, it's literally the word, the term to go after. In what my person goes after to try to find because I'm craving some other life than what I have. So I want to make that distinction between desires in the Old Testament with that word of craving, of longing, of greed, and soul longings, God longings. Something beautiful. The distinction has to be made because he's not saying, I want you to long. I want you to thirst. I want you to hunger. I want so much, but I don't want you to crave after something that's not enough for you. I want you to have these beautiful God longings and dreams, dreams of influence and dreams of destiny and choices of integrity and purpose. I want you to hunger to have your life count, but not these desires of greed and lust and longing and trying to get something to make my life make sense. So Solomon, he says, okay, how do I best paint this for them? He describes a life that most of them would have, most all of us would say, I would like this life. He describes a life with endless wealth, honor from men around you, women around you, people, respect, no lack in any area, never a lack in any area, anything that you want, you get to have, a large family, and a long life. Other than like certain cereals, what would be anything that you could add to that? Let's say God does give you what you desire. Those cravings, those longings, those greediness. Let's say he gave it all to you. Anything, you name it. Because you want what you want your desires to be met, to make a name, to prove your worth through what you have and where it takes you. So let's play this out. Let's say God actually gave you what you want, all that it would take for your soul to lack nothing of what you desire. That's what he says in those first couple of verses. By the way, who's he talking about? Him. He's talking about himself. Remember in 1 Kings 3, he says, God says to him after he makes that prayer, Solomon says, God responds, I've given you what you have not asked, both riches and honor, so that there will not be any among the kings like you all your days. I've given you all the things. You didn't even ask for it, but I'm giving you endless wealth, endless honor, lack of nothing, a large family, a long life. And yet, gosh, such an odd-sounding next statement. And yet God does not give him, wow, an active choice of God, an active doing of God. God does not give him the power to enjoy them. Whatever it is you have, Solomon says, it's stupid. It's ridiculous. I don't get this world where somebody works hard, like me, for example, Solomon would say, and once you get all this stuff, God doesn't allow you to enjoy it. Why would that be? By the way, I would have said up until age 27 that I knew what joy was. But I didn't. Looking back now, I knew what pleasure was. I knew what elation was. I would say I knew what fun was, but I didn't know what joy was. In fact, I lusted as a substitute for joy. I don't think we've talked about joy, but we haven't defined it yet. So let's take a moment and try to give it a definition. Mark, go ahead with that next. Joy, now this is my definition, a deep state of unshakable contentment and well-being, which transcends and is independent of circumstances. It is unable to be earned, bought, or manipulated. It can be experienced only as a byproduct gift of choosing to trust God with the life He has given you. Period. Joy is a deep state of unshakable contentment and well-being which transcends and is independent of circumstances. Well, why would He not provide the power to enjoy if He gives the ability to have? Why would God withhold enjoyment from anyone? Joy is one of God's favorite currencies. He is the banker and the bank, and apparently He plays favorites with it. Remember early on in Ecclesiastes, right after I came back from the stroke, we read these verses. For apart from Him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? For to the man who pleases Him, God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy. It comes no other way. Faith is what pleases God. When it says He gives it to those who please Him, remember, those who please Him are those who believe Him, period. Believing Him, taking Him at His word, and acting upon that word, delighting in the life He's forming for me, and allowing myself to be present for each moment, allowing His will in me to be the trump card in my decisions. Not some good old boy code that I made up that sounds good. Not so I can get a superior life of joy from Him, but because I've already gotten everything I need from Him and it has made me joyful. To such a man or woman, God gives the gift of enjoying whatever he or she has or doesn't have. And it's not an event-by-event hocus-pocus. Oh, I'm going to try hard so that I can enjoy this moment. No, it is a way of seeing that gives a joyful way of life. And maybe you are this far in the book of Ecclesiastes and you are finally saying to yourself, almost out loud, I am so weary of setting up the right conditions and having it fail me and missing out. I want the gift of enjoyment. Oh God, please show me how. I don't want to miss it anymore. The second in that outline, the quality of what is in front of you surpasses the promise of what you desire. Lust after, greed after, long after. All a man's labor, verse 7, is for his mouth, and yet the appetite is not satisfied. For what is advantage does the wise man have over the fool? What is advantage does the poor man have knowing how to walk before the living? And then he says, what the eye sees is better than what the soul desires. Gee, it all feels like a futility and a striving after wind. But the truth that he's giving us now with people with new natures, oh, what we can do with this. One of Satan's cruelest tactics is to keep you from enjoying the present moment by preoccupying you with what you think is missing. I just want to stand there and let you look at that for a while. One of Satan's cruelest, feels like one of his most obvious ones too, cruelest tactics is to keep you from enjoying the present moment by preoccupying you with what you think is missing. See, verse 7 tells us we can work so hard to be able to get what our appetite craves, but if we crave it, it will not satisfy us when we get it. And so he goes on to talk about what difference is there between the fool or the wise man. What advantage does the wise have or the fool if the wisdom doesn't teach you how to enjoy the life that wisdom brings? What advantage do you have in knowing how to walk in society if your life skills don't teach you how to enjoy the walk? And then he says, what the eye sees is better than what the soul desires, than what my person longs after and craves after. He's saying, I don't care what kind of day you think you're having. I don't care where you live or whatever it is. He says, what you can look at right now is better than anything you can desire. Isn't that crazy? Anything you can hunger after, thirst after, crave after, lust after. Where you are right now, he says, it is better. This here is the best place. Why is it better? Have you seen some of the stuff I see each day? How can you say it's better? In my imagination, the things that I can desire, oh my, those are better. He says, why is it better? Because it is what God supernaturally allowed to be brought to you today. Even the hard stuff. And he loves you more than you love you. And he's really powerful and stuff. He can make fish to fly and form sunsets that cause you to recall and to dream. He can turn death into life. And any moment, he can cause it all to turn on a dime. Sometimes that moment, like an eclipse, comes only once a lifetime. So it's best not to be missed. An assignment for you. Look around today as you walk your neighborhood, or driving around town, or in your room as you lay down at night, with all of its imperfections, all of the things that are in your world, this is the real world. It is your life. A good and loving God has given it to you, and it's better than the imaginary life that may never exist. And even if it one day does exist, it has no value in the present. And if the imaginary life was better than this, don't you think the God who loves you as much as his only son would give it to you? The ability to say, this is in front of me. This is now. God loves me and knows how to move me to the next. He knows how to protect me in the here. So while I have preferences and visions and dreams of what I'd like to do, I don't want to miss the now. For the now will always be where God lives with me. He does not live with me in the past or the future. Though he knows the future, he does not live there. So it is better to learn to enjoy where I am, even in a painful season. For this is where God lives with me. Well, now to come to this part. You don't know yourself well enough to know what's best for you. Kumbaya. And you don't know the outcome of the world that you would set in motion. Only God does. These verses I kind of want to take a little time with because they're a little confusing. Whatever exists has already been named. He's basically saying God was here before you. In fact, let's pull up those slides. Let me go back to 6:10, maybe, if I didn't mess that. Oh, maybe I just said it wrong. God was here before you, verse 10 says. God knows how you work better than you do. That's why he says, and it is known what man is by God. Third, God is stronger than you. Who can dispute with who is stronger than he is? And so why would you want to argue with him? That's his whole premise here. God was here before you. He knows you so well. He loves you so well. He knows how you work. I have no clue how I work. Every day I'm a mystery to me. Amen. Aren't you just a mystery to yourself? You're not a mystery to God. And he happens to be, and this is just out, God is stronger than you. So why would you want to argue with him? It's okay. People say all the time, I'm arguing with God, and I go, hip, hip, hooray. You know, it's fine. Knock yourself out. But he's right, and you would not be if you argued with him. It's okay. You can argue with an umpire if it makes you feel better. Throw your helmet and stuff, but he's not going to change his call. C.S. Lewis says, to argue with God is to argue with the very power that makes it possible to argue at all. So let me have that next slide. Verse 12, he says, for who knows what is good for a man during his lifetime, doing his few years on this earth? He's saying, you don't know what's really best for you. Oh, and by the way, for who can tell, at the very end of that verse, who can tell a man what will be after him? He's saying, you don't know the outcome of your choices. You don't know what's going to happen. Say only this. We only see life in fragments. So you don't know what's best for you, he says. And you don't know the outcome of your choices. You don't know what you're going to set in motion. There's only one who does, and it's God. Did you ever wish for something you thought was just right for you, and then when you got what you wished, you didn't want to have it anymore? Apparently not. Anybody? Yes. I have 10 pairs of multicolored shoes in my closet. I thought they were the coolest things. Oh my gosh, you've seen me in those shoes. I thought they were so, the turquoise and the other stuff. My wife will not let me wear them anymore. They are an embarrassment to the, and they can't be sold because no one else wants those shoes. I thought they were it. I don't know what's best for me. God knows every single thing that happens on this planet, even the things that make no sense, like a flat tire on the freeway. You know, sometimes there's just things that happen that you just go, I don't get it. Now, what cause did that serve? What were you teaching me in that one? It was just a flat tire on the freeway, and it didn't seem to do anything for me. I didn't learn anything from that. It just seemed random and inconvenient. And here's what this passage is teaching. He knows what he's doing. He knows what to create from what seems random or unnecessary. I used to think it was always that God was trying to teach me something. Every moment was, what am I supposed to be learning from this? I remember a man prayed over me in a service. He hugged me. It was up at Woodman Valley Church in Colorado Springs. And he was just holding me, and he said, and it was so beautiful. He said, Lord, let this neuropathy not go a second more. Let it continue and on until John has learned what he needs to learn from it, and then not a second more. And I thought at the time, that's so cool. Well, I'm going to get right on to learning what he has for me, and because I want this neuropathy to stop. No, I just have neuropathy. It is the result of the fall that I help cause. And sometimes God isn't trying to teach me anything from it. He's just standing with me in it. Remember, the benefit of faith in Jesus is not that bad things will not happen to you. They will. Sometimes, as often or even more than for those with no God, the benefit of faith in Jesus is that every bad thing that happens will not be wasted. God will use all of it for your best and his glory. So let me give remember, never give 7 steps to anything, but let me give you 7 observations that kind of tie this all together for me. Gosh, how does Solomon know all this before the cross? But he does. This is why we're learning Ecclesiastes. If he doesn't have it for you, you really don't want it. Secondly, not a single thing is withheld from you that you need. Not a single thing is given to you that will not work out for your best. And fourth, this does not mean that you have to pretend to like everything. And fifth, this does not mean that bad things will not happen to you. And sixth, this does not mean that you cannot argue with God. But seven, to rest in God's character changes the quality of your life. That's what this passage is teaching. To rest in God's immutable, unchangeable, perfect, beautiful, sacred, loving character, it changes the quality of your life. This is maybe a bigger and more costly, more courageously costly understanding of trust than some vague word that God keeps using. It means that I must allow Jesus to stand with me in the middle of my now. Not to just tough it out, but to be present in the pain and to allow Jesus to hold me presently in the pain. This is why we come to this table. It is the place of pain and the place of victory. It's where Jesus, in his broken body and his shed blood, he wins. And he wins for all of us. And now we, in him, we win. Jesus Christ meets me in my now at the table. I'm going to tell you a hard thing because I think it ties this message for me together very well. I hope it does for you. I have no desire for it to violate anyone. But it's where Stacy and I were yesterday. We flew to Dallas to be at a memorial service. My stepbrother, Mark Appleman, his precious wife's name is Christine. And Christine is one of the most beautiful, spirited, most tender-hearted people I have ever known in my whole life. And she looks like Amy Grant. Except she's prettier. And but she struggled with alcohol. She was for 30 years an alcoholic. And so she was in groups and support groups all along. But she had another addiction that she never told anyone. For 30 years, she had an eating disorder. She never told her husband, Mark. I married Mark and she 14 years ago. And she kept it hidden. And she didn't know how to... It just caught her off guard. And in the hiddenness of it, it scared her. And she took her life. Love Jesus so beautifully. And it tells me this so powerfully. There is a lie of shame. And it's why we talk about it every week. The lie of shame says, you are not enough. It says, if you really knew me, if the real truth about me was known, you would abandon me. She was terrified of that. To her husband, she would say, Mark, if once I could tell it's spiraling out of control, I'm drinking again, I couldn't stay sober in that addiction, I know what's going to happen, and you're going to have to abandon me because I'm going to ruin us. And she didn't know that if she had told those truths, everyone would have surrounded her completely. It's the lie of shame. And it's not just hers, it's all of ours. We all know that story. Secondly, I just once again was so grateful for this community that you know me. That in this room, there's so many people who know me. And I don't have to hide. You guys, You have to become a person who is trusted by others so that you can get to love someone and they won't hide. There has to be this kind of way of seeing. And then there was a third truth that came out of that for me yesterday. Because Mark, as we were driving home, said, "I don't know, every single day there's a moment in there where I don't know how to make it." And I just said the only thing I knew how to say was, "Mark, Jesus enters and feels to the exact extent that you are feeling all of your pain. Let him hold you. Run to him. Stay in the present. Stay in the now. Stay in the moment. And let him hold you until it passes. It will pass. Don't believe the lie. Let someone in who can love you. And then stay in the moment with Jesus Christ. He is powerful enough. He feels it with you. He has at least as much as you do. And let him hold you until it passes. This is your God. This is his gospel."